Well, good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to this program Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician at Christie Clinic, and he is with us once a month. It's always on a Thursday. And we talk about children's health. And the idea is that we've built it into the show so you'll have this regular opportunity to ask questions. Anything that you could think of that you would ask a pediatrician, you can call in here and ask Dr. Bocek. And I know he will do his best to give you an answer. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point you had questions, you can give us a call. Well, thanks for being here once
good
again.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Just before we were talking, we were chatting a little bit about this, about the chickenpox vaccine. We probably talked a lot about that over the years. And I said that just to, here in the news, I think that I had heard that the state had decided not to make that one of the required vaccines for kids before they go to school. And your comment was, well, for now. That's it. You think at some point chickenpox will be added to the list of all those things, all those shots that the kids have to have?
I don't know if I think so or I hope so. It is a good vaccine. I think there's a lot of people out there saying, gee, how long is it good for? And I can't answer that. I think some of the initial trials, this is a Japanese OCOS strain. It was developed in Japan. My understanding is some of the initial enrollees, it's now 30 years past, and they're still immunized against chickenpox. So I don't think there's much question that it has long-lasting immunity. Whether it's lifelong immunity or not, can't answer that. Is it safe? Yeah, it seems to be real safe. Is it 100% effective? No, nothing's 100% effective. And about 10 or 15% of the kids who get the vaccine will develop chickenpox, although the data seems to suggest that it's a much milder form of chickenpox, less lesions, less fever, so they are more comfortable with it. Are we going to save any lives with the chickenpox vaccine? Well, yeah, maybe about 100 a year, so we're not going to do a whole lot that way, but we are going to save a lot of kids the discomfort, misery, lost school for a week. We're going to save the inconvenience to parents of having to find alternate care for these children while they work for the week, and there's been not a single reported case of shingles in anybody who's gotten the vaccine, so I think it's a good deal. I suspect where the state's problem is, how do we know if they've been vaccinated or not? Do we take parents' word for it that the child has had chickenpox, or do we make them take a blood test, a titer for it, which is about $60, and it's a blood test, and I think if I were the health czar of the state, I'd say it's mandatory. Yeah, we'll take your word. We'll trust you. If you say your kids had chickenpox, we'll trust you. And some are going to sneak through that way. But over the next decade or so, eventually, we're going to get everybody.
Yeah, we're going to get everybody. Okay. Well, something else you mentioned that I hadn't heard of. Apparently, there has been a shortage of the vaccine for diphtheria and tetanus.
Yes.
And so that means that you have people who are lined up and should be getting it and wanting to get it, and you don't have the stuff to get
yeah.
it.
Yeah. We have the DPT, the diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus for the under school age and the 5 and under. There were two manufacturers of diphtheria, tetanus toxoid. One apparently found it non-profitable or something and stopped making it. So we do have a shortage of it. So the ninth, all the kids going into high school are supposed to get a booster dose of it, or every 10 years after kindergarten, you're supposed to get a booster dose of it, including you adults who are probably under-immunized out there. Mm-hmm. So we don't have that for booster doses, for routine dosage now, and it's thought we probably won't have it till the year 2002. So kids, it's a reprieve. It's not a pardon. We have long memories in our office. We'll keep track of you. But there will be, there are no booster doses of that. Now, we do have a limited supply of vaccine available. So those of you who step on rusty rakes and that sort of stuff, who have tetanus-prone wounds, please do call your doctor and please do get your boosters for that. Or your booster doses for the high-risk wounds. But for those of you who are up for your every 10 years, you've got a reprieve.
Okay. We have a caller and would welcome others. If you have questions for Dr. Bocek, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we do have the toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Our first caller here is in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Hello, doctor. I was told recently at one of the local HMOs that the one local school district, I'm not certain which one, is requiring kindergartners to have a hepatitis B series before they can attend school.
Yes.
That surprised me. Should I have been surprised, or is that just standard protocol now that's medically necessary?
No, that's been standard protocol for the last, ooh, gosh, I don't know how many years. 5 or 6 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Are they pushing, is the medical profession, as part of protocol, pushing hepatitis B for adults as well? Or only on certain risk categories?
Oh, gosh. You know, the risk categories. I suppose anybody who's sexually active is in a risk category.
Okay.
Anybody who might need a our blood supply is probably 99.9% safe, but I think theoretically anybody's hepatitis B is a blood and bodily fluid transmitted disease. So not everybody's at risk, but certainly probably our biggest population of those with hepatitis B right now are the intravenous drug users, the needle sharers.
Okay.
Certainly, medical profession, dental profession, those people that deal with blood and bodily fluids are at high risk. And I think one of the concerns is, gosh, you come across somebody with a bloody nose, that puts you at risk, too, if they happen to be carriers of hepatitis B. So it was sort of it's sort of a hard call, and I think it's a right call that everybody get hepatitis B, although probably it's a minority of our population who are at risk, but it's sort of one of those things where you never know when you're going to be at risk.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, I guess now, again, my question, now I start thinking, well, I've never been vaccinated against hepatitis B. Here I'm 48 years old. Following up on the question of the caller, should all adults, if you haven't had this, should you go to your doctor and say, well, you know, I haven't had this, maybe I should have it?
You know, again, I think it's how much are you at risk? And certainly if you're in the healthcare profession or the dental profession or an EMT or something like that, yes, if you – and the other problem, you know, are you ever going to be – are your kidneys ever going to fail? Are you ever going to be a dialysis patient? That may put you at some risk. Our blood supply is well looked at, but, you know, we do our best to keep our blood supply clean, but can we say it's 100% clean? And are you going to be in an auto accident where you're going to bleed and somebody with hepatitis B is going to bleed at the same time? And so I think weigh your risks. I think in your case, David, I don't think I'd worry about it too
okay.
much. You know, I think your risks are very low, and I don't think I'd worry about it too much.
All right. Other questions are certainly welcome here. If you'd like to talk with our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek, he's a pediatrician from Krista Clinic. He's here every month on a Thursday. We talk about children's health, and you're certainly welcome to call if you have questions. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. I guess just going back to the thing we were talking about before, the fact that there's a shortage of the booster for diphtheria and tetanus, and this is the one that kids who are in high school age are supposed to get. You can't just go ahead and give them the DPT, the one that also has the pertussis in there? Or is that a completely different thing?
That's it. Yeah. At this point in time, the answer is no. The reason being the old pertussis vaccine gave a whale of a reaction after age 7. I mean, really, a dysfunctional arm for, 3 days afterward, just a whale of a reaction. We are now using the so-called acellular pertussis vaccine. There's studies going on now of giving this to adults to see how it's tolerated, because after age 7 or so, none of us are immune to pertussis. So And we know there's a lot of pertussis in adults and teenagers during the winter, the prolonged cough, and it tends to be a mild disease in adults. But if we give it to an unimmunized infant, it can be a deadly disease to them. So we'd like to immunize adults against pertussis too, but we don't know if we have a safe, effective vaccine yet. No studies are ongoing now with the new so-called acellular pertussis vaccine.
Okay, so the day may come when that would be a thing that we would recommend for adults too.
Yes.
Because as you say, it's the kind of thing that adults can get and they can pass around. And for an adult to have it, apparently it's not such a big deal, but you don't want babies to get it. Okay. Another caller here. This is Belgium, line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I understand that you're a pediatrician, but I had a discussion with a friend of mine who is a research chemist for Lilly. And he's just been put on a project that they're starting to work on. It seems though there's a disease that's just beginning to come into the population. It sounds pretty hideous. It's a blood disease, and it thickens your blood to the point that it no longer flows through your body and obviously kills you. Have you ever heard of this or anything?
I guess I think I need more information on this. There's a couple of The clotting mechanism, there's a balance within our body. We certainly want our blood to clot. If you cut yourself or something like that, you certainly don't want to bleed to death. But then you don't want uncontrolled clotting going on in the body either. And there's some people that are deficient in a couple of proteins where they tend to clot a little bit more. They may not unclot. They clot too. They clot too well. It's quite rare. Most of the people with these protein deficiencies never have any problem in their whole life. The other thing I can think of is there's polycythemia, the opposite of anemia, where people make tremendous amounts of red cells, so their hemoglobin, hematocrit are very, very high. Their blood is very, very thick, if you will, and it just doesn't flow very well. So, yeah, I don't know what he'd be working on.
I would think if it's something they're going to start a large project on, that it would be not a rare disease, but a much more a coming disease. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that's where I have problems, because I can't think of any disease that's particularly common where you have trouble with clotting or where the blood doesn't flow right.
Yeah, I'll look into him, talking to him a little bit more, because it sounded very, very ugly. Be completely honest. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Right,
thank you. And again, other questions, welcome. 333-WILL or 9455. We also have that toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call for you, use that, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-WILL. And again, our guest this morning is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician from Christ Clinic. Well, once again, it seems that meningitis has been in the news, and we come back to this question. We've certainly talked about it before. For people who have kids who are in college or headed to college, because this seems to be the place, I guess, that is one of those diseases where it's best passed around when you have people who are living in close quarters. Yeah. So, for example, the places we've seen it in the military, guys living in barracks tends to be passed around. And then on the other hand, it's in colleges where people are either they're living close together in dorms or they're packing themselves into bars and what have you. And so the conditions are right for passing that around. And so we come to this question, well, should you, as a prophylactic measure, would it be a good thing to have your kids vaccinated?
Yeah. The official answer is probably not, unless there's an epidemic. The vaccine we currently have is not particularly good. And I think the other thing, meningococcal meningitis always makes the news. Well, the truth of the matter is, folks, there's 900 cases a year in the United States. About 20% of them, 20-25% of them are going to die. So we're talking about maybe 200 deaths a year. There was an outbreak recently in Ohio where I guess there were 2 deaths and 60-some thousand people lined up for prophylaxis, of which 60 probably needed it. But the current vaccine. The other thing is, most deaths are not college-age kids. Most deaths are preschool-age kids. actually, but it's the college, high school age kids that make the news mostly. And the vaccine we currently have is particularly worthless in the preschoolers. It's a polysaccharide vaccine, and they don't respond well to it. There's a vaccine out in Europe now that looks pretty good, so maybe someday I can wholeheartedly recommend immunization. But right now, unless there's an epidemic going on, I can't very well recommend the immunization. I think the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics goes along with this. There's an Academy of College Physicians or something that I think is going a little bit the other way and suggesting it. But at the present time, I don't recommend it. In general, there's no official recommendation for universal meningococcal vaccine for young children or high school age children or college age children. And I guess in Ohio, there were so many people in line for prophylaxis. Boy, I'd sure like to see the line at the bike helmet section of our local stores that long. And, you know.
So you think there are some other things that might be, you'd put higher on the list of things to do to protect yourself against injury.
Like the 40,000 people who die in motor vehicle accidents every year, the 17,000 people that die of head injuries every year. I think there's 40,000 people dying of acute lead poisoning that is being shot by bullets every year. And I think there's, yeah.
Okay, very good. We have someone here on a car phone. We'll go right there. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, we've got a question for the doctor on potty training this morning.
Okay.
I have a son who is going to be 5 in September and can't yet make it through the night. And sometimes during the day, he just chooses not to go.
Okay.
And consequently loses control point. But say he's playing, he's having too good a time, and he just doesn't want to break away. And so I don't know if you had any suggestions. Is this just normal development and he's just taking a little longer than some, or, you know, what you have to suggest? So I'll just hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. The short answer is I don't have anything to suggest. I think we've got two things going on here. The daytime, yeah, he's just not, like you say, you know, during the winter and that sort of stuff, he did fine during the day. It's now when he's outside playing with the guys that he just says, well, you know, maybe I can hold it a little bit longer because I don't want to, you know, tell the guys that I'm going in and leave, and, you know, going potty because they might go someplace else while I'm gone and I'll miss out on things. And I think this tends to be an early summer problem. And as summer goes on, it tends to take care of itself. And I think, you got to change your pants and, you know, wish you hadn't done it will suffice as far as the daytime wedding. The nighttime wedding at that age, he's got company. He's got about 25% of his peers doing the same thing at night. And the other, I would venture to guess, there's a good chance that you did it too. There's about an 80% chance that a close family member also was a little bit delayed about sleeping through the night without staying dry. And what we think this is we think this is an arousal, it's an internal arousal delay. There's nothing really wrong with these children. There's nothing you can do about it. I put them to bed in a pull up if I could, if he would tolerate it. I don't want these kids punished or anything. Fluid restriction. Well, if he's taking a 6-pack of some beverage to drink after bedtime, I'd certainly cut that down. But I wouldn't, especially in the summer, let a child go to bed thirsty. Put them in pull-ups so you don't have an extra load of laundry to do in the morning, and kind of leave things alone. And with age, this goes away. After age 7, technically, it's defined as abnormal. We can intervene, and I will sometimes do it, sometimes won't. Depends what how bad the problem is. But we think it's a defect in arousal at night. These kids are literally sound sleepers. And with age, the arousal mechanism seems to awaken, and the bedwetting stops.
Hmm. And why? Because it does seem that boys have a little bit more of a problem than girls do. Do you have any reason why?
Backwards, because actually we boys have a far better sphincter system than girls do in theory, and And perhaps it's because we boys are just a little bit, we're just a little bit slower than girls are all down the line. As far as reading readiness and everything else, our development is just a little bit slower. Maybe that's why the boys outnumber the girls, but it is predominantly a male problem.
We are almost here at our midpoint, and if you have questions about children's health, this is the day to call in. Our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic in Champaign and is with us on the program every month, always a Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour. We built these shows into the schedule, so you'll have a regular opportunity to talk with a pediatrician. Anything that's on your mind, your kids, grandkids, nieces, nephews, the children in your life, can be health, development, behavior, anything that you think of discussing with a pediatrician, you can call in here and talk with Dr. Bocek in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number to call. And if it would be long-distance call, 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. What do you think is a good resource for toilet training? And I guess we maybe even want to question the very term that we apply, because I know you've talked about it in the past and said that it really is an issue of developmental readiness. So that they have to be ready to do it. So it's not so much a matter of training as it is. It's just they grow into it almost. But are there particularly good resources, do you think, good places for parents to go for advice on, okay, how exactly do we deal with this? How do we help the kids through this?
I don't think so. And again, I guess since I really object to the term toilet training, that it's not our job. There's many books out there. I think if you go to the bookstore, you'll probably find 4 feet by 4 feet of various books, from toilet training in one night to, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I think it really is a question of readiness and example. Boys are a little bit slower than girls. And, oh, yeah, this boy who's wetting at night and during the day might be worth a trip to the doctor. Make sure there's no urinary tract infection or anything like that. But boys tend to be ready sooner than – or girls tend to be ready sooner than boys. They get interested about 18 months. They get serious about 2.5. So by 2.5, most kids are in control of their bowel and bladder function. But again, we have, you know, a substantial minority that takes longer, particularly for bladder function, to step in, especially at night. Fluid restriction is not appropriate. Punishment is not appropriate. And I think mainly it's just, you know, sitting them on the potty periodically, letting them watch mom and dad use the potty. Now, dad, not such a good example, because dads tend to stand up when we urinate, and little kids, well, girls obviously aren't equipped, and boys' legs are too short at that age. So dad is not a good example. So unfortunately, it's probably mom's job mainly. But don't be modest. You know, let them see what the potty's like, and let them know that it doesn't bite their bottom. And let them sit on it as soon as they're interested. If they do something, if they sit on it, they get a round of applause. If they accidentally do something on it in the beginning, it is an accident, they get a standing ovation. Treats, I have nothing against it. You know, if they'll sit for a M&M or something like that, I think that's a great idea. I think certainly it's fine to, you know, the 3-year-old boy who's still having bowel movements in his pants, which is not uncommon. I think it's perfectly okay to say, gosh, this is yucky, this stinks, this is gross, let's change you, and that's enough. We won't belabor this anymore, and just let it happen.
Okay. To another caller here in Savoy, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I didn't catch the first part of your program, so I hope I'm not raising a repeat issue, but my question stems from a recent news report regarding a mother who had postpartum depression and drowned her 5 children. I guess my question is, are women screened for this following, you know, giving birth to a baby? Is it through their own gynecologist or obstetrician, or do you as a pediatrician screen families for more socio-emotional issues?
You know, I got to confess that I'm probably bad at it. But I think, I think this screening should be done by anybody who has contact with that mother postpartum. You know, and I guess either I've been, you know, focused on the baby, and I hope I haven't missed a significant one, but I think as a pediatrician I focus on the baby, and I think as pediatricians we ought to be aware of, yeah, how's this mother functioning? Because we may be, as pediatricians, you know, and family doctors and that, we may be a good source of finding these women too, because what, after a baby, how many postpartum visits do you have with the obstetrician? But you see us, you know, fairly regularly, and I think, yeah, I'm guilty as charged. I probably ought to do a better job of saying, gee, are you okay? You know, how are you feeling? Although, as far as I understand about that case, that baby was 6 months. I think the baby was 6 months old, so I'm not sure. You know, that's sort of the postpartum depression I'll be resolving by then, so I'm not sure of all the, you know, what all's going to come out of that case that's made the news recently. But I think anybody who's in contact with that mother postpartum ought to say, gee, are you okay, and do you need help? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay.
All right, thanks. So it sounds like that there is really, there's no formal kind of mechanism to do that. So a pediatrician can have little conversations with the parents and just say, you know, how you doing? How's everything going? And hope that you would, if there was something, that you would pick up on it. But it sounds like it's the kind of thing that could easily slip by.
Yeah,
it could easily slip by doctors and if the woman was not, for some other reason, maybe regularly seeing her physician or didn't recognize that there was a problem and sought out help, that it could be kind of the thing that would just sort of get by everybody.
Yeah. And I, you know, not being an obstetrician, terrible depression happens, and sometimes terrible things result from that depression.
Well, that gets an interesting point that as a pediatrician that and appropriately so, what you're focusing on is the baby and how much of your time can you spend or do you end up spending? I mean, I don't mean just you. I mean the pediatrician.
In general,
how much time really does the pediatrician have to talk with parents and just ask those questions? Say, well, you know, how's everything going? You having any particular problems or anything you want to talk about? Everything okay? And particularly when we're talking about not so much, you know, what's up with the baby, but what's going on with you.
And I suspect there we're still going to lose a lot of them because it's going to be, you know, how are you and Celeste getting along? You know, did you have a fight yesterday? I mean, you know, you're going to say no. You know, everything's cool. Everything's fine. And so I think we're still going to, we're going to miss these. Even under the best of circumstances, we're still going to miss these people. They're going to deny and put up the good front and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, we're still going to have these rare but unfortunate incidents.
Yeah. Well, we're a little bit past midpoint. We certainly have time for other questions. If you'd like to call in and talk with Dr. Bochek, you can certainly do that, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. I just happened the other day to be out, and I just noticed somebody putting sunscreen on their baby. It was in a stroller, and they were inside at that moment, but I knew that they were going outside. I thought, well, you know, that's a pretty good thing. So I guess the message has sunk
around.
In there. It is recommended that, as we do as adults, if we're spending a lot of time out in the sun, we're supposed to be doing it. We're saying also that babies, we ought to be conscious of their sun exposure too.
Yeah, and I think, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think there's a sunscreen safe for under 6-month-olds yet, so keep those babies out of the sun. Keep them in the shade, and you can get strollers and that sort of stuff with the awnings on them and that sort of thing. Babies have thinner skin, so they're probably at more risk for a more severe burn from the sun, and everybody's at risk, and if you got red hair and freckles, you seem to be at more risk too. So applying sunscreen is important. Renewing your sunscreen is important. The SPF 15, what that says is if you normally burn in 5 minutes, you've got 15 times 5 minutes before you will burn. Some of them are waterproof. Some of them aren't water resistant. So if you've been swimming, maybe you need to, when they get out of the pool, slather it back on again. And I think Ed always says, 10 to 4 p.m. or 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. is when the sun's rays are most direct, and that may be a good time to bring your kids inside to watch a video, or it's summer, read a book. They can still read a book. and maybe find some activities outside of the sun.
Okay. You still seeing teenagers, or are we still seeing teenagers where they just think that being out there is and getting as brown as possible is the greatest thing, and we're still having to push that message, particularly with adolescents?
I don't think as much, but yeah, we're seeing a lot that use the tanning salons. And, you know, UVA, UVB, I think the data is that neither ultraviolet wave is particularly good for our skin in the long run, and it's probably not a good idea to use the tanning salons.
Yeah, I know that our friends in the dermatology community would like to say, just don't do it.
Yeah.
All right. We'll go here to another caller in Champaign, line one.
Dr. Bocek, could you comment, please, on the cause and treatment and dealing with bipolar children who have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, please? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. I'm afraid that I'm probably not a very good commenter on this. Kids with bipolar disorder exists in children just as it does in adults. I think it's generally accepted that this is a biochemical type of illness, but it's nothing that we can measure. And I think it's generally felt that these kids probably deserve medical treatment, medication, as well as counseling treatment, and it can be a serious lifelong problem. Period. That's all I've got to say.
Okay. It's not something that you've seen a great deal of in your practice?
No. No. Fortunately, no. It's uncommon.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or it's uncommonly diagnosed. Again, maybe it's like postpartum depression. Maybe we're not paying enough attention.
Yeah.
Or the other problem is, you know, if you go through the DS, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, I think each of us have at least one major diagnosis and four comorbid conditions, too. And I don't mean to belittle the seriousness of something like bipolar disorder, depression and that, but I think my bias is we're putting a lot of labels and a lot of medications on a lot of people that I'm not sure we're guaranteed happiness day after. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure we're not guaranteed happiness day after day that way. So I think the pendulum has swung a little bit too far as diagnoses and the medicalization of moods and that sort of thing. But I think there, you know, again, there's no doubt that there's bipolar disorder that is disabling. There's no doubt that there's panic attacks that are disabling. There's no doubt that there's depression that's disabling and that is entitled to treatment.
Yeah. It seems that we're now more willing to make a diagnosis of psychiatric illness in children than we have in the past. And then I'm sure people will ask that question, well, does that mean that we're actually, children are sicker now, or it's just that in the past we didn't recognize the fact, maybe we didn't think about the fact that a child could have depression. We just said, well, that's a grown-up disease, and what do kids have to be depressed about? Yeah. And we perhaps weren't fully appreciating what their lives were like and the fact that it's perfectly possible for a child to be depressed as an adult.
And I think even when I was a resident 300 years ago, there was talk about these, you know, the 4 and 5 year old that was hit by a car, that some of them indeed were suicides. These kids weren't chasing the ball. They ran out in front of the car because for whatever reason, life was not satisfying for them and they didn't want it anymore. And suicide is still one of the top three causes of death, certainly in adolescence. So I don't mean to belittle it, but I think the other thing, yeah, we are increasing the you know, everybody's got a psychiatric label now. Are we driving our kids nuts? Literally, are we you know, when I was in kindergarten, you were expected to eat a snack and not beat up on your classmates and take a nap. Now, if you're not reading ready, you're not kindergarten ready either. And developmentally, is that indeed true? I hear tales of kids involved in athletics in school, which, you know, how can I badmouth physical involvement in this society that's full of obese people? Well, I can't, but, you know, when these kids have a 16, 18-hour day between school and athletics, no wonder they're feeling a little bit bad. I heard recently of a coach yelling at his team because they beat the other team, the other soccer team, by only 25 goals. And you say, gee, this is a sport where, you know, you win 1-0, something like that. And, yeah, why do we want to, humiliate others so deeply? Wouldn't 5 goals or 10 goals be enough? And, yeah, are we just putting undue pressures on our kids and kind of forcing them to the, you know, I can't do it anymore point? Socially, with the amount of divorce and remarriage and stepchildren and that sort of stuff out there, gee, is this the, where do I live this weekend? And who am I staying with this weekend? And who might my other spouse have as a friend living this weekend? And what are the rules going to be this weekend? And I think we've put a lot of, we've hurried our children along. There was an author we had in town, gosh, I guess about 15 years ago, wrote a book, I can't remember, David Elkind, wrote the book, The Hurried Child, and I don't think it's changed. I think we're still pushing our kids along. You hear about the beauty contest for, well, the JonBenet Ramsey. What are we doing putting lipstick and low-cut gowns on a 5-year-old and parading them down an aisle? It just seems sort of inappropriate to me. Let's let our kids be kids.
We have about 10 minutes left here. You have questions, you can call us. Dr. Robert Bocek is our guest. He's a pediatrician from Krista Clinic in Champaign, and he's here every month. We talk about children's health. Whatever's on your mind, anything that you might take up with a pediatrician, you can call here and talk about the issues with the doctor. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just kind of a related item, I was thinking again about going back to the subject of the fact that now we are more willing to make a psychiatric diagnosis in kids, that if then you're going to go ahead and treat and use medicine, well, you're relying on drugs that were developed for, tested on, approved for adults. And so then you ask some questions about, well, are those medications appropriate in children? Then that kind of gets me to the question of just how common is it that you're ending up using medicines that were indeed developed for, tested on adults, and how many of those medicines are actually approved for use in children?
Hardly any.
That's kind of
I think as pediatricians, that's never bothered us. We've been using drugs for, you know, long time that have no approval in children. And I think within the last couple of years, I think the rules have changed and drug companies are required now to look at the safety and efficacy of many of these medications in children. But that's never bothered us as pediatricians for forever, using drugs that aren't approved.
Well,
for
do you figure
children.
That a child is it's the same species, and chances are, as long as you make sure that you're careful about thinking about the dose, that something that's okay in an adult should be okay in a child.
Yeah, they're basically organizationally, organismally, biochemically, they're the same. So yeah, we'll just, if they weigh a quarter what an estimated adult was, we'll kind of give them a quarter dose. See what happens.
Okay. Well, we have another caller here, Matt Toon, line number 4. Hello?
Yes, sir. It's just, I was kind of listening there about the suicide in the kids and the pressure on the kids. My view of it is that, and this is kind of, it's been created by us, mainly by the generation above. I'm I'm 34, and because of the, you know, we're being so open with everything. Our society accepts divorces. They accept, you know, kids at the age of 10 and 11 already identifying their sexuality. Those kinds of things. I think we're breeding this ourselves. And people are so afraid to say, hey, maybe our thinking is wrong. You know, what we're doing is wrong, and nobody wants to be wrong. And I think that's part of our problem, because nobody, out of all the problems we have and all the things that are wrong right now with society, everybody wants to point the finger, and when they, but they don't want to stop and look and say, wait a minute, how were these kids raised? What were these kids allowed to do? You know, look at what we're doing to them, like what he said there, and I totally agree with him. I think there's way too much pressure. Kids aren't allowed to be kids anymore. I mean, if a kid likes to play with insects, oh, he must have some psychological problem.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. He likes the little bug, you know? And, I mean, I'm speaking from a neighbor of mine that actually had a child that took it to a psychologist because this kid just has this infatuation with bugs. He likes little bugs. He just,
yeah.
That's not a psycho.
Kids
that's
like dinosaurs. Curious. Some kids like bugs.
Exactly. And it's just a curiosity thing. And I think this free-loving and, you know, oh, well, you're divorced. That's fine. Okay, well, you think at 10 years old you're a homosexual. Well, I'm sorry. I don't remember. I know at 15, heck, I was still didn't know half of the knowledge about my body or life, let alone know what kind of sexuality I have. And I think parents are the reason these kids believe this way, and that's either way. I mean, there's a lot of pushing. You see 12 and 13-year-old girls and boys going to school where they have to have the $100 jeans, and that doesn't make them better people.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think the schools are trying to deal with that now. Uniforms. You know,
exactly.
I think the parochial schools have had that for a long time, and now it's trickling into the public schools, and I think it's a good idea. And you know what feedback I'm getting from the parents? It's a great idea. And am I getting any complaints from the kids? No.
Well, and the silly part of it is the First Amendment, everybody screams and cries, and people are saying that's their First Amendment right to express themselves. They're children. We're parents. Our job actually is to express who they are until they're through school. Yes, they have some individuality, but as parents, I think another big problem is too many parents try to be their friends of their children instead of being the parent. And I think that is a lot, because kids, when they don't have a parent to look up to, as a parent, a kid looks for authority. And if it's the, you know, if it's the group or whatever, I think they cling to things like that. And I'll let you all go and get some more phone calls. I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you. I think, yeah, I think we do need to listen to our children. You know, if all of a sudden their grades are declining, yeah, what's going on? And I think we need to listen to our kids' likes and dislikes. I think they have a right to express an opinion. But I think you're absolutely right. We have the right of parenthood or dictatorship or whatever you want to put it. But I think as parents, we have the right to say no. You know, no, period. And I don't think we need to share. Well, you know, dad's job's a little bit uncertain, or mom just quit work and we just don't have the money now. Maybe it's just no. And, you know, and if the kid's 16, then you can explain, well, you know, financially we're in a little bit bad shape. But when the kid's 5, talking about that sort of stuff is probably not necessary or appropriate. And I think we need to maybe as parents, I think one of the mistakes we do make is we don't listen to kids. And by listening to kids, I mean listening with our ears. I mean watching kids to see what their mood is and how they're functioning. And I think basically, as I've said many times, we're looking for a change in function of kids. Is, you know, if they're doing well in school, they're having a good time with friends and that sort of stuff, probably everything's okay. But I think you're right. We've got kids raising kids now. From a very early age, I think, you know, we've talked about daycare centers before, and I understand the necessity, I think, of both parents working, but I'm also a little concerned at the same time that we're warehousing our children with the guys. You know, you've got one or two adult supervisors for 8 children or more, and you say, gosh, when you got 8 or 10 active 3-year-olds, that's a big job. And so you wonder what kind of, yeah, are these kids getting the true support we want, or are they sort of, you know, the adult daycare providers saying, you know, about the best I can do with these active 3-year-olds is keep them out of trouble, keep them from falling out of windows and that sort of thing. So are they really getting what they need, or are they getting what we're giving them? And I think our society is creating its own problems with its busyness, and we're not letting kids be kids. We're not letting kids just daydream, and I think daydreaming is important for kids. Not in school, certainly, but I think the summertime may be a time to daydream. And boy, I'm doing camp physicals now, and boy, it just exhausts me to think what these kids are doing all summer. And you say, why does this kid need to go to a volleyball camp, a basketball camp, a baseball camp, a cheerleading camp? And then they're going to go to their church camp too. And you say, gee, I can't really say that any one of them's bad, but you say, are we over it? Yeah, are we getting our kids overly involved in other things so they don't have enough time to just think about themselves and their future?
Well, we're about the point here we're going to have to finish up for this month. Any last thing you'd like to?
No, I'm sorry. You know, I think I've editorialized enough today, and I apologize if, but. It seemed to be the way this hour went.
All right. Other than use your sunscreen, wear your bike helmet, and make sure your kids have plenty of water.
And skip the meningitis vaccine.
And no meningitis vaccine. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Robert Bocek, he's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic in Champaign. He's with us every month right here on the show, always on a Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour.